Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Thursday, January 18th, 2024. We are now well into January, and a very cold January it is, at least up in these parts. As you can see, I've left my studio because our internet has been out since the big storm last weekend and then the polar vortex, and I feel for the guys and people that are out there trying to get the wires put back together, but it's going to be a while. So I'm broadcasting here from my home office and didn't want you to miss 1 minute of quality critical thinking when it comes to the economy. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Eastman Financial Report. We really appreciate your viewership. We appreciate your viewership on WVW-TV as well. As you know, WVW-TV has been broadcasting great content since 2006. And it's our mission and ministry to bring to you the ideas and thoughts that you're not going to hear on the mainstream media. We're not a commercial network. We don't sell advertising, and we're not beholden to advertisers. We take our editorial content very seriously, and we try to bring you what we feel is the best information available at the time. And we do that around the clock. Basically, there's live programming during the day. And, of course, at night, if you're up at 2 o'clock in the morning, like I have sometimes, you can watch the reruns. So if you missed the Eastman Financial Report during the lunch hour, you can always catch me at 2 in the morning on the reruns. But the point is, all of this stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum. There's costs involved, and we appreciate all of you viewers who donate to the WVW-TV Foundation, because that's what basically keeps us on the air and keeps the content flowing. And we appreciate your kind support, generous support, and also your kind and generous viewership as well. We also operate with our corporate sponsors who sponsor programming, and a longtime sponsor of WVW-TV is Swiss America Trading, and of course they sponsor my program as well. So I'm very happy to talk about them and explain to you why they are a really great choice. If you're thinking about increasing your holdings in tangible precious metals, or maybe perhaps buying some for the first time, you might want to be looking for a strong partner. I mean, you can buy gold and silver on the internet, and you can buy it at the big box store. But when you make the decision to convert your Federal Reserve notes into gold or silver or platinum, you may want to be talking with an expert, a company that's been around a very, very long time. And that, of course, is Swiss America. They've been not only a sponsor for WVW-TV for a long time, but they are professionals in that space. And the people who work there, they know what they're doing. They're trained, they're professional, they've been around a long time, they've seen the ups, they've seen the downs. So when you're thinking about buying some precious metals for strategic reasons or investment reasons, you want to be dealing with a strong partner, and that's where Swiss America comes in. You can reach out to them at 1-800-519-6271, and you can tell them Dan Eastman from the Eastman Financial Report sent you. They're happy to send you some free information on how the market works and how, you know, how does this all work? How do I go about buying gold? You know, they'll tell you. You can also go to their website, very convenient, SwissAmerica.com, and you can shop around and see what they have to offer. And there's plenty of information on that site. If you use the promo code Eastman on the website, that stands for Eastman Financial Report, they'll send you the same free information as if you call. So if you are really thinking about ways to diversify your holdings, or maybe making a more meaningful birthday gift or a gift to somebody, a wedding gift, that's certainly an idea that precious metals might fit the bill right there, because it's something that is precious. It holds value, and you know, it's designed to be a hedge against inflation. So if inflationary pressures continue to build, then that's probably a better place to be. So anyway, give Swiss America a call, 1-800-519-6271, or go to the website, SwissAmerica.com, and shop around, see if that sort of investment or that sort of purchase is right for you. Buying in gold, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon, but, you know, when we think about it, there's an investment component, but there's also a purchase component, and there's also an inflation hedge component. So it's a bit of a complex area, and that's why you'd want to, you know, learn as much as you can. So give them a call. Okay, let's jump into the news today. And of course, being January 18th, it's a little bit of a slower news day. the markets. It's Unemployment Thursday, of course, so we'll talk about that. Let's talk about that first. A big drop in unemployment claims week over week from last week to this week, and last week was down, I think, 202,000. Well, now it's 187,000 new claims. And of course, we look at two metrics. We look at the new claims of people going off to the unemployment office to file for unemployment. And then we look at those who remain on unemployment from week to week. And the continuing number still holds around 1.8 million. So any delta, any small change from week to week isn't going to impact the continuing unemployment number in any dramatic way, because people fall off the back end when their benefits run out or they get a job. That's good for them. And people are coming in on the front end. And of course, the idea is to watch trends as to whether it's trending up or trending down, and sort of watching the expansion and contraction. What it tells us is, in the American economy, at least for purposes of filing unemployment, that the job situation is certainly not in crisis. You're seeing a stable job force, and you're seeing a lot less turnover in jobs. If you look at the turnover numbers, people who have a job are kind of holding on. They're not ready to quit and go looking for the next one, because it may be a while, and you may end up showing up in the Thursday number. But at the end of the day, we're not seeing a crisis in unemployment in the United States, and that's a good thing, especially when you think about going into an election year like 2024. The last thing in the world the current administration needs is high unemployment numbers, because that certainly doesn't bode well for re-election prospects. But we are happy that, at least from the purposes of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that we're not seeing a crisis in unemployment. So We'll leave it at that. December, I want to talk about single-family home numbers. And I've talked about housing metrics from time to time on this program. And keep in mind that these are very difficult numbers to measure because of the time lag involved in real estate development. There's the idea of buying a piece of land and then doing a subdivision map, and then you put in the roads and the sewer and the water and electricity and all the utilities. And then you start selling off the lots, or maybe you'll build some spec homes, and then you sell off the rest of the lots. It takes a long time to do that. And the whole process of starting construction on a home, if you've ever gone down that path, you know that it's not something you do really quickly. You have to get yourself a lot, and then there has to be the proper zoning, of course, and then there has to be a building permit issued, and you have to submit plans to some architectural board, perhaps. And at the end of the day, these things do take time to get the shovel in the ground and then build the home, and it takes a period of time to actually construct the home, and then you got to move in, you know. So when we see that in December the single family home starts were down 4.3%, then that's not really surprising, because trying to start construction on a home during the holiday season is a bit iffy, and in parts of the country like I am in Wisconsin, that's probably not the best time to be digging the foundation hole and starting the process. So it's not uncommon to see that, but I would suspect that in spring we'll see a number bumping up. And of course, that's also dependent to a great extent on current interest rates in the market with respect to mortgages. And yesterday I was off the air because I didn't have internet. We just simply couldn't get it going on a hotspot. But the day before, I was talking about the impact on the 10-year federal treasury note, and the fact that those trade in a very, very global market. The 10-year is sort of a benchmark. It's just not too short, not too long. It's just the 10-year, and mortgage rates, automobile rates, credit card rates, lending rates, they tend to key off the 10-year note. And of course, that, you know, moved up a little bit above 4% again. And what that tells you is that puts upward pressure on consumer-driven interest rates. So when we think that home starts falling in December, then maybe we're going to, you know, maybe we'll see what it looks like in January as well. But there's still a lot of pressure in the system, in the money system, with respect to interest rates. It's kind of a difficult time that we're in, because, as we've talked about in the past, the Federal Reserve, the United States Federal Reserve System, is the Open Market Committee. That's one of their functions, is to control the interest rates in the economy, to try and speed it up when it's too slow and slow it down when it's too fast, and just find this sweet spot of perhaps full employment and 2% inflation, and that's the dual mandate, and that makes for a happy world. And of course, it's never that easy, because there are always lags involved. So when the Federal Reserve starts to tweak the interest rates, bump it a little higher to slow down the economy, in normal times that works, and historically that has worked. That's part of the Fed's open market activities. And it's basically was designed that way, to inject money into the system to speed up the ball and then contract the ball by pulling money out of the system. And what we've talked about in the past is that with the massive federal deficit that we now have in the United States, this $34 trillion plus dollar deficit, the debt markets themselves are starting to take note of that. And when that happens, markets are a very supply and demand driven place. Markets are very pure things, and they react. And notwithstanding all of the attempts to regulate them, they function on information. And it's really, you know, there's an old saying on Wall Street that greed and fear are the two primary motivators on Wall Street. And in fact, that to a great extent is true, that people will get in when they think the market's going up because they want to become rich. And then when they see the market going down, they sell because they don't want to become poor. So there's always this reaction to what they see. And that's why information in the marketplace is so important. And that's why organizations like the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, their job is to make sure as best as humanly possible that information on traded listed securities is high quality, and it's honest, and it's not tainted, and it's not front running, and it's just pure, as pure information as you can get. And I think when you think about the Securities and Exchange Commission in the 1930s, how slow news moved. You had the morning paper and the afternoon paper and the telegraph wire and the wire houses out in the Midwest, you know, they'd get the information from New York. It moved rather slowly. But today, information being digital is instant, and it's very, very complicated when you are trading. If you want to come and change your career and become a Wall Street trader, a bond trader, a stock trader, it's a lot different than it was, you know, decades ago, because it's all algorithms and it's all very much based instant numbers. So when the big debt market is analyzing this constantly increasing deficit spending, bigger, 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 with no apparent discipline in Washington, that sends a signal that if you are in that market and you're holding a position, you've taken a position in the market, and your capital is at risk because you paid X dollars for that position, and of course you want it to go up and appreciate and make more money, and then your numbers will look good and you'll get a big bonus, or it could go down and then you've lost money for your client, and then maybe you don't get a bonus at all, or worse. So there's a real-time pressure in these markets. And when the bond markets start to see what's going on at the federal level, they are reacting outside of, here's the little, you know, the Federal Reserve tweaking around with their interest rates at a quarter point. The markets have just sort of moved past that. And that's why you're seeing that the market is setting a rate that's different than what the Fed would prefer. And the Fed had power when the debt was small, because then you could move markets. You know, you could inject and contract. But when you've already injected $32 trillion into a marketplace, it's pretty hard to imagine you can issue a few more notes or sell bonds in or pull bonds out and affect interest rates. And I think that's what they're seeing right now. And that's why we're seeing such a divergence of opinion from Federal Reserve presidents around the country as to whether the Fed should effectively raise rates, leave rates alone, or cut rates. And of course, the U.S. Treasury, the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, would prefer we cut rates because it's costing her more money. Every time she goes and issues new federal debt, the interest rates are higher than they were. That means, you know, coming out of the federal treasury, theoretically, it doesn't. It's borrowing interest. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of pressure that is inherent in the system because of the massive debt. And there are some economists who would speculate or stipulate or, you know, suspect that if the the debt isn't reduced rather dramatically, then the Fed's ability to conduct monetary policy slips away. And it becomes a much more volatile ride as people are reacting. There's the greed component, more, 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 and the fear component, there's too much, too much, too much. And this is something that the Federal Reserve has not faced in the history of the country, or at least the history of the Federal Reserve from 1913 on. And as a result of that, when we think about how do we order, have an orderly market for interest rates and debt and securities, if the markets are so focused on a massive debt that it's not repayable, it's just too big, then suddenly you lose more control over those markets from the regulatory perspective. And I think that's becoming a problem. And I'm going to be watching that. I think that'll be, as far as academic research goes, I think we're going to be looking, there'll be some interesting research done to try to decide whether the Federal Reserve has lost the ability to control the punch bowl, as they say. So we'll see what happens. Okay, I want to talk about a few other items. The Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank does its survey, and it shows that manufacturing is down again. It's 18 out of 20 months. It's down. And that suggests a soft economy. If you remember the New York Federal Survey came out last week, I talked about it. It's the same thing, New York, New Jersey, parts of the Mid-Atlantic region. And what it's telling you is that, we're not seeing high unemployment, but we're not seeing a robust manufacturing sector. Now, keep in mind, the United States is an economy based to a great degree on service. It's not the old manufacturing economy of the 1900s, but manufacturing is very much at the core of wealth creation. It's an important sector because the people who work in manufacturing, they have great salary and benefits, you see. And as manufacturing slows down, then what you're finding is that as those unemployment numbers start to tick up, you're seeing a diminution in the general well-being and welfare of all Americans, basically, because there's less income being earned on average, so it reduces the average national income. That's why we're watching that. We saw Texas, we saw New York, we see Philly, and that's sort of a broad, it's not regional at this point, it starts to be half the continent. And I think that's an interesting problem as well. Excuse me, still recovering from this weather we're having. I wanted to mention also that the president, the current occupant of the White House, is accelerating the SAVE plan for forgiving student loans. And I sort of took a look into that because the United States Supreme Court had brushed away that general amnesty that so many Americans were counting on because they believed the politicians and they thought they were getting their debt forgiven. But they're pushing ahead with this plan. If you'd borrowed, if you'd borrowed $12,000 or less, and you've been dutifully making your payments for the last 10 years, apparently that puts you in the window of forgiveness. So you would have your remaining, whatever your remaining outstanding debt is, forgiven. And we'll sort of watch that because this has been a very controversial issue. And certainly student loans have been a drag on the consuming public. When you look at the gross income and national spending trends, the shock of having to start repaying student loans back in September, October was palpable. You could see it in the numbers. And then we know that 40% of the people who have these loans are still struggling to make payments. It's sort of an interesting thing. So I'm not sure if this news story is just talking points for a political campaign or if there'll be court challenges. But I guess if you're in the situation of having less than $12,000 and you've been making your payments, there might be a little break coming your way. But then you have to ask the question, in an inflationary economy, what's $10,000? Except if you owe it, I suppose it's important. But, this is not the program that that's going to be a general amnesty. I also wanted to comment on the net savings as a percentage of gross national income. There are numbers out today that show that only for the second time in history, the net savings of Americans have dropped below zero. First time was in 2008 when the when the wheels came off the liar loan banking phenomenon. But now we're seeing that again. So it's kind of a bump in 2008, and it kind of went up, and now it's dropping negative again. And when you think about that, you know, from a perspective of a healthy economy, especially with a consumer base that is effectively in debt for $34 trillion. And then you're seeing that the individuals themselves don't have savings available on a monthly or an annual basis. So it really, if you track this negative in savings, is when you get a major surge in national debt. At that very same time, you see these numbers going negative, 2008 and now again in 2023. And that doesn't really bode well for Americans who are trying to live their lives and get ahead. When you think about inflation and, of course, the student loan, you know, burden, a lot of people in the U.S. have student loans. They're handing these things out like quite loosely. And at the end of the day, when you have that type of a problem with the net savings rate and negative, the people who are stuck owing the $34 trillion, you, me, everybody else, if you're American, we're getting poorer. We're not getting richer. And that's a real problem because you're dumping more and more and more and more debt onto people who are getting poorer and poorer and poorer. And at some point, there's a day of reckoning. And I think that's a day that will not be a happy event. So, okay, I also wanted to talk about two other things in the energy space. There's a story today about container ships. And I've talked about container ships in the past from time to time. And of course, those are those great big boats that have those great big boxes on them. You see them on the back of semi trucks, you know, because they, when you make stuff in China or Asia or around the world, basically, and the stuff has to be shipped across the seas, you will normally put it into a container. This isn't like commodity things like grain and, you know, stuff like that. And these are products. And you put the products into containers and you ship them to wherever the import market is. And of course, we have been talking since COVID about how the container ship industry was really, really in a world of hurt because there was so little being shipped into the U.S. market and the European market because the aggregate demand for those types of goods had declined. So that was a thing, and that was the story, that these poor shipping companies are sitting there, and you could, instead of $23,000 for a container, it's now $2,100. It's like one-tenth of the cost. And if you were shipping, it was a great time to ship because you could get all these containers cheap, and it cuts your cost of shipping. And, of course, if you think about my revenue minus expenses as income model, expense line, of course, includes shipping your goods to your customer, assuming you're paying to do that, or they are. Either way, somebody's paying to ship stuff, and it's a cost. Well, with the situation with the Red Sea, it's very tenuous at the moment. And of course, shipping containers come from China and India through the Indian Ocean up into the Red Sea, through the Suez Canal, into the Mediterranean Sea, to the big ports of Europe. And the Europeans like to buy stuff too. And they import a lot of things through that pathway. Well, the problem is with the war situation in the Middle East is that various factions are now shooting at the container ships. And of course, that's really a danger because these are not military ships. They're commercial ships carrying TVs and refrigerators or whatever. But in order to extract, wartime efficacy, I guess, by shooting commercial ships, then you gain brownie points in your side. But at the end of the day, if you're a company shipping materials through the Suez Canal, you've got a real problem. Because if you look at a map of the earth, I don't happen to have one here, but the Suez Canal was a great time saver to get goods into Europe. Because before the Suez Canal, you'd have to go all the way around the Horn of Africa and then up the coast of Africa, and then you'd have to get to England and Spain and wherever you're into, through the Rock or the Strait of Gibraltar into the ports. It was a lot of diesel fuel, you know, once they stopped sailing ships. It was expensive. So the Suez Canal saved a lot of time and a lot of money. And of course, it's a strategic point. And those belligerents, of course, know who that there's hay to be made by shooting at the ships going through. So it is deferred, distracted, where shipping companies are not using that path because they don't want their ships shot at or blown up. So of course they have to sail farther away. And of course, if you're in China, you can just as easily go east as west, because there's oceans all around. And at the end of the day, the companies who are shipping are now scrambling to find containers and container ships, and those prices, of course, go on through the roof. And usually when you're in a situation as a business and you want to ship things, you will forward contract your shipping containers. If you kind of know how much you're making and you know how much you ship every day, and there's somebody in a cubicle that'll calculate these numbers, and you will forward contract for containers. And if you've overcontracted, well, then, you're paying for it whether you need it or not. So there's a place called the spot market. And there's a spot market for every market. There's a spot market for gold and silver and iron and, pork bellies and whatever. And that's the real-time trading market where you put that in, and somebody who just happens to have undercontracted needs a container, and you go to the spot market. It's not a physical place. There's no buttonwood tree that you huddle under. It's a digital platform. But what it does is it matches people who have them with people who need them, and there's a price, and that's the spot price. And those spot prices, of course, have gone through the roof because people who need extra containers to get their stuff around Africa are, you're basically stuck paying pretty good prices right now for the spot containers. And I think what that does is it increases the cost to Americans and Europeans of consumer goods at a time when we're battling inflation. We're dealing with the core is 4% and the headline is 3.4 or 3.5, whatever. And at the end of the day, what the Federal Reserve is doing is trying to find hope within the numbers that the inflation is dropping back to 2%, so they can cut the rates and, American can start buying homes again and everything. Well, this puts more pressure, the opposite pressure on that situation, because the more stuff costs to get here, those costs are always passed on to the consumer in the form of not only the cost of the goods shipped, but also the cost of getting it here. And shipping is a big deal. I mean, it's a big deal in America because, most of us buy things online, and, that blue truck shows up, the guy jumps out and throws it on your porch. And when you think about that, more and more consumer goods are being purchased online and as such require somebody to pay the shipping, not only to get it to the, the Amazon warehouse, but then from that last mile from the warehouse to you, versus the old retail model, which they conveniently shifted the cost of shipping to the consumer when all the retail stores opened up. Because if you think about it, back in the 1800s, you had Sears and Montgomery Wards and some of these big catalog companies. They would distribute catalogs throughout the cities and countryside, and people would look, and then you'd fill out an order form and mail it in not even a check, you send cash. And at the end of the day, they would deliver it to your house on a horse-drawn wagon. Well, then the merchant said, we can save a lot of money if we get the customers to come to the distribution point rather than sending it right to their house. So that's when the retail era began, and everybody had a car. So instead of waiting for the horse-drawn buggy to drop off your refrigerator, you went and picked it up yourself, shifting that cost to the consumer. Well, now we've really doubled back. When you think about what's happening in brick-and-mortar retail, it's not a pretty sight. I mean, it's sad to see. But what they've basically done is shifted the model back to you order online and we'll ship it to you. In some places, I've noticed, you order online and then you can go pick it up at your local store and they'll ship it to that store. But it always requires shipping, and that shipping is in the cost. And those costs will be reflected in inflationary numbers because somebody's paying for the fuel and the time and the containers and the, the labor to drive the truck. All of that gets wrapped into the cost of the goods we buy. And it's all inflationary. And that's why fighting inflation, the Fed's in a very difficult position right now. Not only are they trying to move $34 trillion in debt and have that ocean, that whale in the ocean, not tip over their canoe, but at the same time, they're battling with a mechanism that was designed for a country and countries that have a much lower national debt. Okay, that's it for my report today. I'm not sure where I'll be tomorrow, but I'll be somewhere. I'll be on your screen at 11:30 Central Time. Thanks so much for watching, and I appreciate your viewership. Thank you for supporting WVW-TV. We appreciate that. Have a great afternoon. Bye.